Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. It is your support that makes this show possible. You're listening to about one third of the show that we have for you. If you want to hear the whole thing, head over to ROFpodcast.com. That's ROFpodcast.com. Sign up to become a member. It'll cost you a couple of bucks a week. You'll get the full show. You'll get access to all of our archives. You can look at some of the amazing interviews that have been done on this program over the years. Not just by myself, but by Bobby Kennedy, by Mike Papantonio, and you'll be keeping independent media alive. That's ROFpodcast.com. Become a member today. Thanks so much and enjoy the show. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, journalist Anthony Fisher will join us to discuss his piece in the Daily Beast regarding the characters behind the so-called intellectual dark web. Jim Keady will join us to discuss his run for Congress in New Jersey's 4th District and why running on a strong progressive values is the key to his victory. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to break down all the big news stories from this, again, crazy week. And Ian Mulheiser will join us to explain the ramifications of Justice Neil Gorsuch's first major opinion, which allows employers to basically steal wages from employees. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com and sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to help me analyze the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So Heather, of course, another incredibly busy week. Let's start, though, with the foreign policy, I guess, to the extent that the Trump administration has a foreign policy. This week, within really a number of days, we've gone from Donald Trump lobbying for the Nobel Peace Prize for denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula to... looks like nothing's happening. Walk us through what has been going on, then we'll talk about the forces that are acting upon it.
Well, I mean, I think that you have to go back, I think, a couple of weeks to recall that, you know, the Trump administration was already taking a victory lap on North Korea, claiming that Kim had agreed to denuclearize, that he was, you know, they'd already achieved all the concessions that they need, that it was really just a matter of going and, you know, going to the summit, and Donald Trump would, you know, immediately receive his Nobel Peace Prize afterwards. And this Nobel Peace Prize thing is actually quite serious on the right. They really and truly believe that Trump is going to receive it for, you know, as he puts it, he wants to do this for the world.
Right, they have to, because so much of Donald Trump's presidency is in reaction to Barack Obama.
Right.
They need him, you know, and he probably feels the same way, needs to get the Nobel Peace Prize to sort of maintain some parity with Obama.
Right, and even I think it has to be a better Nobel Peace Prize, because he's going to, you know, he will be the only president, as he puts it, the only one who ever understood what was going on with North Korea or really made any effort to, you know, bring peace to the world and ensure that this, you know, dictator, who he now says is excellent and honorable, as he's going into these talks. In any case, yes, you know, he needs to get that in order to be better than Barack Obama. Otherwise, he's failed. So all this was carrying on, and I think we were all a little bit you know, wondering. I mean, there's a part of anybody, right, who, I mean, we certainly would prefer to have some kind of a deal with North Korea that would allay fears about a nuclear confrontation. I mean, I don't care, you know, I'm as hostile toward Donald Trump as anybody, but if he could pull it off and it was something real or even just temporary, you know, I'd be, you know, if it's like the South Koreans said, you know, they can take the prize, we'll take the peace, right?
Yep.
So, you know, give him the
peace. No, I agree.
Give it to him, you know, whatever. But, you know, but as it turns out, of course, you know, Trump is being played and played hard by North Korea, and now it appears perhaps China as well for other reasons. As it turns out, you know, the North Koreans issued, you know, everything was being set up for the meeting, which is right on, you know, what is it, 2 weeks now, that they, 2.5, 3 weeks, that they're planning to meet in Singapore. And all the plans were going forward, and then all of a sudden North Korea just launches a tirade complaining about John Bolton saying publicly, which the idiot did, that they were going on the Libya model. Now, everybody in the world, except Donald Trump, of course, knows that the Libya model was, you give up your nukes, we will help you economically, and then not help them economically, and then overthrow them, and they end up being killed in a ditch.
Literally.
That's the Libya model.
Literally, yes.
Literally.
I mean, you say to the leader of a country, we're going to model you after the guy who gave us what we wanted and then was murdered, you know, in the street after being sodomized, essentially, I think
right.
is what. I mean,
like, right.
That's
like saying, you know,
the
We're going with the Tsar Nicholas and his family model, you know. I mean, this
right.
is like, you know. So that didn't go over very well for obvious reasons. Now, the North Koreans knew very well who John Bolton was. They had dealt with him before because he was the head of the Arms Control Department at the State Department back when the Bush administration backed off of the earlier, you know, sort of strategy to engage North Korea back in the early 2000s. And, you know, they know who he is. There's no doubt about that. And they understand what he has been saying constantly for the last two decades, which is that, you know, there has to be regime change in North Korea. So they get that. But they waited until just a little bit before the meeting was scheduled to take place to launch this you know, angry statement, taking exception to Bolton's discussion. Now, Trump came out on TV then and said, oh, no, we're not doing the Libya model, and then went on to give an incoherent rant about confusing the nuclear deal with that the U.S. had done with Gaddafi back in the early 2000s with the overthrow. And somehow or another conflating the two things as if they were all part of the same thing, and then threatening the North Koreans with that again. So that didn't really work. He clearly doesn't know what the Libya model is and doesn't understand what saying it means to the North Koreans. So he basically, you know, kind of doubled down on John Bolton without meaning to. I mean, it's pretty clear he doesn't understand. Now, throughout all this, we're getting reports that Trump is refusing to take any briefings. He's not doing any preparation.
Heather, let me just back up 1 minute, because we should also add there's a couple of other things that took place in preceding this. First off, this is not the first time we've heard this Libya model comment, right? I mean, about a month or two ago, we heard it then as well, which was also sort of ridiculous, but it just sort of everybody just sort of blew through that. I would also add that, like, about 2 weeks ago, there were planned joint exercises between the South Koreans
right.
and the Americans, and North Korea said, "Hey, we're not going to go to South Korea now because of these exercises." And the exercises were more or less shut down to preserve this. So basically, what we're dealing with is a North Korea that had been waiting for some type of leverage point to start to do what they're doing now. It's unclear how this is going to end, of course. But there was a lot of speculation when Donald Trump went and gave them essentially, you know, the idea that we're going to meet with you without any preconditions was a big mistake. That the North Koreans were sort of like, we're playing Donald Trump. and this would be consistent with that. But there are also, and you wrote a piece on in Salon about this, there are also people in the Trump administration who have an agenda to make this fall apart. We need to take a break. When we come back, let's talk about the sort of the cross currents within the Trump administration in terms of foreign policy. And Donald Trump is actually, it appears, being played by both the North Koreans and his own advisors.
Right.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm talking to Heather Parton. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, you were basically walking us through how we got to where we are, which is we don't know where we are when it comes to the administration and North Korea. The North Koreans reacted to John Bolton saying, we're going to use the Libya model with you guys, which ended with the Libyan leader shot dead in a ditch after he gave up nuclear ambitions. And there was one other thing that I also noticed that also took place about a week ago. And this is Mike Pompeo saying that the U.S. ambition was to make sure that North Korea could not threaten the U.S. with nuclear weapons.
Right.
Basically leaving our allies, right, Japan, South Korea, very vulnerable. And so I want you to take it from here, because you wrote a piece that there are members of the Trump administration. In fact, it seems like the Trump administration has been working against North Korea, you know, some type of detente, I guess, with North Korea, as well as North Korea may be sort of working against this because they have no intentions of giving up anything anyways. And they've basically, to play Donald Trump would work domestically for them. But talk about those factors in the Trump administration that are undercutting maybe Donald Trump's promised Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, you know, I think that's... That's an excellent point. I mean, you have, and I think these are very important people. They're not just, you know, some functionary who comes in at a meeting. I think we're talking about Mike Pompeo and we're talking about John Bolton, who are the two most powerful foreign policy advisors in the White House right now. In fact, James Mattis, the Pentagon, has kind of faded a little bit, as has John Kelly. But even both of them are not exactly what you'd call, you know, North Korea doves. So what it seems to be happening is that people need to let Trump have his moment. You know, he's got to have, and in fact, maybe if the meeting takes place, the word is that Trump is spending all of his time on the pageant, not on any of the substance. And it may be that that's all that happens, is that there's a big pageant, he marches around wearing a costume, and a bunch of people cheer, and there's some, you know, kind of a parade or something. And that's enough for him. And maybe they've sort of sussed that out, that they can give him that. But on the substance, it's pretty clear that there is nobody in the White House right now who is really arguing for some kind of a peaceful solution. That's not who they are. And this was known before they were hired. At the same time, you have North Korea, which, of course, they have absolutely no intention of denuclearizing. Disarming, which is really the right word. Denuclearization is kind of weird, but nuclear disarmament is not really on the table with North Korea. And, by the way, they'd be fools to do it. They have the Libyan example, and let's not forget that Trump just backed out of the Iran deal, just did it right in the middle of this whole thing, basically told Iran, hey, suckers, sorry, you know, our word isn't worth the paper it's printed on, so, you know, we're out. And, you know, essentially made it very, very clear to the world and certainly to the North Koreans what they plan to do. Meanwhile, now, there's a new wrinkle in all this in which Trump is now starting to blame the Chinese
right
for this. Now, he always talks about his great relationship with Xi and how they are just best buddies. They eat chocolate cake together
chocolate
and everything.
Cake.
But he's blaming him for somehow changing Kim's mind in that meeting, that weird meeting that took place where Kim got on the strange North Korean train and went up and met with Xi a couple of weeks ago. And Trump now seems to get it in his head, and I'm not entirely sure where this is coming from, that Xi is the one who has pushed North Korea away from their, you know, Nobel Prize-winning peace deal with Donald Trump. So that's also colored by the trade negotiations that are going on between the United States and China right now, which is also, you know, playing into this whole thing. And Trump, of course, is so far, he's so in over his head on this. I mean, this is really, this would be complicated for anybody. You know, the Clausewitz would have a hard time working his way through this. And here he is, you know, this guy, and, you know, as he's attempting to do this, he's obsessed with the Mueller investigation, and he
right.
can't even
well,
think.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. The guy doesn't have any capacities and abilities in this area. He has a cadre of advisors who have a very explicit agenda when it comes to these things, right? I mean, they couldn't be more one-dimensional and explicit in their agendas, guys like Bolton and Pompeo. And they are their agendas in terms of China is fairly straightforward. In terms of Iran, they are playing him. I mean, he is being tooled by Pompeo and by Bolton and probably, you know, others who share their perspective that, you know, whose names we may not know or be readily available. And that's what's going on. I mean, certainly Donald Trump did not divine that it is China and Xi Jinping who is, screwing with his deal with North Korea. It's his advisors who
yep.
are also basically giving him, you know, some type of face saving out. And so that instead of it being like, well, you got played from Jump Street or you got you stuck your foot in it too many times. It's China's fault, of course.
Right.
And I mean, this is. It is fascinating to see the president of the United States be so obviously manipulated and to being so manipulated without the implications because there's such a low bar of expectations for this guy. But Heather, we got to take a break. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about from this week, and we will have to do more of that in the next hour. I'm talking to the great Heather Parton, who's going to join me in the next hour. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, congressional candidate Jim Keady will discuss how his activist background is the blueprint to his first run for office. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Our next guest has been known for his campaigns to boycott the top sports brand in the world, Nike. Now he's in a new fight to win the upcoming primary in New Jersey's 4th Congressional District. Here to talk about his campaign, Jim Keady. So, Jim, tell us where you are running for. And I should also say, you know, full disclosure, I don't have many candidates on in running for primary races, but... I think I first interviewed you with Janine Garofalo on the old Air America on the old Majority Report, maybe, I don't know, 14 years ago. And yep. at that time, you had made an incredible stand of conscience as an athlete. And I want to get to that, but I just want that full disclosure. But first, tell us where you're running for office and why.
I'm running in New Jersey's Fighting Fourth District. It's pretty much the center of the state from the east on the beach all the way across the state to Hamilton, just short of the state capital in Trenton, made up of three counties. Majority of it is in Monmouth County, some of Northern Ocean County, and two towns out in Mercer County. And I'm running for office because I believe that we have far too many people down in Washington, D.C., that are doing the bidding of the billionaires and the oligarchs and the giant corporations, and it is time that everyday people had someone who is squarely in the middle class, who's running a Main Street family business here in New Jersey, bringing our bold, progressive, common sense values down to Capitol Hill. And, you know, this is an outgrowth of the activism that I've done for the last 20 years of my life. You know, you had mentioned my work on the Nike sweatshop issue. Probably here in New Jersey, my usual political calling card is, you know, do you remember the guy that Governor Christie screamed at to sit down and shut up? And every New Jersey voter remembers that. And I let him know that was me. And on that day, I was standing up for Hurricane Sandy families. You know, my hometown of Belmar was ground zero when the hurricane hit, and we were devastated. And, you know, years after the storm, we still had thousands of families that weren't back home, and we had hundreds of millions of dollars that were log-jammed in Trenton, and the governor wasn't doing his job. And I stood up to him on that day and was able to help start an organization called the New Jersey Organizing Project that got that money flowing and got more families back home. It's that kind of commitment to grassroots activism and standing up to the bullies in our government or the bullies who are running our giant corporations and giving people a voice that don't always have a voice in the halls of power.
Well, tell us a little bit about the 4th Congressional District. Right now it's represented by a Republican, am I right?
Yep. It's represented by Congressman, we call him No-Show Smith. He has been in Congress for 38 years.
Wow.
He has not lived in the state of New Jersey since 1983. He has been living in Northern Virginia for so long that his kids get access to in-state tuition at Virginia schools.
Wow.
He has not had an open public town hall meeting since my senior year of college 25 years ago in 1993. And he, per congressional record, spends less than 20% of the year in the state. The worst year, I think, was 2006, where he only slept in New Jersey for 8 nights. This is a guy who is physically out of touch with our district. And I would argue, given his political extremism, that he's out of touch with where the majority of the people of the 4th District are at. He's been an absentee congressman. Because our district is, you know, fairly affluent, and it's a, you know, look, I've been lucky enough to travel all of the United States and all around the world. This is a pretty cool place to be. You know, we got 13 miles of some of the most beautiful beaches in the United States. We have, you know, great school systems, great parks. You know, that there's not always the need for people to be calling their congressperson, and this guy's been able to fly under the radar screen. But since President Trump's election, it's one of the few things I thank President Trump for, is his awakening of the body politic, and people are paying attention, and now they're asking questions about this guy, and we have a grassroots political energy that I have never seen in my 20 years of being involved in electoral politics and grassroots campaigns here in this district. This is a guy who is also the leader of the Right to Life movement. Not only does he want to overturn Roe v. Wade, he wants to defund and close all the Planned Parenthoods. He's been on the record saying that he doesn't think women should have access to the birth control pill or the IUD.
Wow.
He also has disastrous policies towards the LGBTQ community. And he's on the record saying that homosexual rights are not human rights, which means for us, as for me as a straight ally, he is saying that my friends in the LGBTQ community are not human beings. His values, you know, he claims his Catholicism. Now, I am someone who went to Catholic school for 18 years. I hold a graduate degree with distinction in theology from St. John's University. I have taught high school religion at two different high schools in our district. So I think I can say with a marginal bit of authority that his brand of Catholicism wasn't fit for 1818, let alone 2018.
All right. Let me ask you this about that district, because I know that it's a strong Republican lean district, right? I mean, I think the partisan index is somewhere around like an R7 or 8, maybe
R plus 8. Yep.
So give me your sense of what you think. I mean, because obviously to beat Chris Smith, and we're going to take a break in a moment, and we'll talk about what you're bringing for a Democratic primary voter. But tell me, what do you think your appeal is going to be in a R plus 8 district? And granted, you know, there's a lot of reason from a generic ballot standpoint to suggest that, you know, that type of partisan index is sort of irrelevant in this election. But what is your message going to be in a general to those folks? What do you think is going to resonate with them?
First, you got to look at the demographics of our district. We have 132,000 Democrats, 148,000 Republicans, and 232,000 unaffiliated voters.
Wow.
So the majority of our district, 47%, is unaffiliated. And a lot of people think, you know, when they hear unaffiliated, they think they're in the middle. They're not in the middle. They go across the political spectrum from very liberal to very conservative. They have just had it with both parties. And if we take and build a coalition of our Democrats with left-leaning, unaffiliated voters, we can get to our win number. Congressman Smith has won this district with approximately 120,000 votes over the last three or four midterm elections. As I said, we have 132,000 Democrats. We've got enough within our Democratic base to get to our win number. The challenge we have is that in midterm elections, over those same three or four elections, only 55,000 Democrats have gotten out to vote. I would argue that's because the party has never made an investment here. We haven't run strong candidates. We haven't run strong campaigns. And we certainly are doing that. I may be biased, but I think I'm a very strong candidate. I know we have an incredible grassroots campaign that has energy, political energy, like I have never seen before in my lifetime. Having grown up, being born in this district, gone to grammar school, high school, taught at high schools in this district, I've never seen anything like what's going on. So we fire up our base of Democrats. We do the outreach to those unaffiliated voters who generally get ignored by the established parties, and we can put together a coalition that is grounded in bold, progressive, democratic ideals, and we're on the right side of the issues, right? When you look at the polling, the stuff that Democrats at least should be talking about, you know, Medicare for all, the majority of the country wants it. I'm the only guy in the Democratic primary, and hopefully we'll be running in the general, who's saying right now, day one, I will sign on to H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, so that every American not only has access to, but actually has health care, because health care is a human right. And, you know, I was listening to one of the commentators, maybe he's on yesterday, or she was on yesterday, or a couple of days ago, I was listening to one of your archive shows, you know, saying how Democrats just have this fear, you know, thinking the country's conservative.
Right.
They're not. We just don't have the guts to stand up for what we believe in. And I would argue, and I don't know if you got to this later on in the interview with her, but as I was listening, the reason that the likes of Schumer and Pelosi and the other leaders, whether at the national level or the state level or even here at the local level, the reason they don't want to go there and really stand up in an aggressive way for what we have, you know, should be saying we believe in as Democrats and what the majority of people want is because of the money. They're afraid to upset their big dollar donors. And if you look at who's bankrolling campaigns on both sides of the aisle, it's the big moneyed interest. And they don't want a big, bold, progressive agenda that's gonna speak up and put policies in place for the 99%, because they know it's the detriment of the 1% that are funding both sides of the aisle. And as Democrats, we at the grassroots have to change this, both within our party and in Washington, D.C.
Jim Keedy, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about, and I think your plan to appeal to the general election, I think, is excellent. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about your history and what I know about you as an activist. And really, I have to say, a person I've met who I don't know if I've met anybody with more integrity than you in my life, and I still remember meeting you almost like 14 years ago. But we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about your appeal within the Democratic race and what you're up against in terms of this primary. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We're talking to 4th Congressional District primary candidate in New Jersey, Jim Keedy. We'll be right back after this. Back on Ring of Fire Radio, I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to congressional candidate Jim Keedy about his June 5th primary in New Jersey's 4th Congressional District. So, Jim, in the last segment, you outlined for us very clearly, I have to say, a plan to win the general election in the 4th Congressional District of New Jersey, where there is an R+8 partisan index. And you made the point, which I think, you know, Democrats around the country are starting to understand, that there are more people sitting on the sidelines than are even voting at this point, and that your appeal does not have to be to the Republican base. Maybe you'll pick up some people on the margins of Republican voters, but there's literally a couple hundred thousand people sitting on the sidelines waiting for an inspiring candidate to vote for. And I'm looking at your website at jimkitty.com, this Kitty for Congress. And I'm looking at your issues. One of the ones that you highlight is Medicare for All. And you made the point in the last segment that on day one, you're going to sign on to the Medicare for All bill in that is sitting in Congress right now. And if it's a Democratic majority, this is going to be there. Walk us through why you think where that sits on the spectrum of important issues for people in your district and, frankly, across the country.
Yeah, I can tell you, when you knock on doors in New Jersey, and you ask people, what's the number one issue you're concerned about? Always in New Jersey, number one is taxes, because people here are taxed to the eyeballs, right? And then when you explain to them that with regard to their property tax bill, that's more decided at the state level, the county level, the local level, and the school board level, and then say, you know, let's talk about federal policy, whether I'm standing on the doorstep, I'm in a living room with a group of people, or I'm in front of a couple of hundred people at a town hall, health care is the issue that always gets the greatest amount of applause when I say I will sign on to and advocate for H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. And that cuts across everybody in the party. It also cuts across not just Democrats, but also unaffiliated voters and Republicans. Healthcare is the great equalizer. You know, if you get cancer, cancer doesn't care if you're a Democrat, unaffiliated, Republican, a Green, if you're rich, if you're poor, if you're black, brown, white. It doesn't care if you're liberal, conservative, cancer is going to do its thing. And in the same way that cancer or heart attacks or car accidents don't discriminate, we need a healthcare system that will not discriminate, that will give every American the level of care that they deserve to get them well. And with the Medicare for All bill, that is how we can get to that point. And we can get ourselves up to speed with the rest of the industrialized world. And as I said, when I'm out there, whether I'm on the stump at a small event, large event, that always gets that, and getting big money out of politics are the two that get the loudest applause lines when I talk at events. Now, you know, you had mentioned, Sam, real quick, you talked about, you know, people looking for a campaign that inspires them, that a candidate that they want to vote for, rather than being forced with the decision of having to choose the evil of two lessers in November. They want someone and something that they can believe in. We have 232,000 unaffiliated voters in our district. 110,000 of them have not voted in one out of the last three elections.
Wow.
Right? And we can go get them.
Now, number two is that big money in elections, and I want to talk about what the obstacles are that you're facing in the context of a primary. Obviously, you're going to face more of those in a general. I also just want to just note that you you support a tuition-free public college, and from my perspective, I hear about that a lot. I think student debt is one of the greatest drags we can have on a society in terms of creating real strong citizens and people who want to go into pursuits that are not necessarily lucrative. And tuition free is a step further even than debt free, because it puts everybody on a level playing field. Give me one more of your top line issues that you pursue as you go out and hear from people in New Jersey's 4th District.
Climate change, because if we don't deal with climate change, none of the other issues that we're talking about are going to matter. We don't have clean air. We don't have clean water. We don't have communities, especially here. I live in a coastal community that was devastated by a superstorm. Right. Within the 4th District, we have 13 miles of beachfront. In New Jersey, we do $45 billion in tourism every year that's grounded in our four oceanfront counties, Monmouth, Ocean, Atlantic, and Cape May. And we need to be pushing back against the dirty energy companies. We need to mitigate the damage that's been done. And look, we have all consumed those fuels that they have provided, so we all take personal responsibility for it. and we need to make massive investments in solar and tidal and wind and geothermal and move ourselves onto a green energy grid. And in doing that, with those investments and creating a new Green Deal, a green industrial revolution, we start to create millions and millions of good paying jobs for everyday people in the 4th District around the state of New Jersey and around the country. So it's a win-win.
All right. Now, Jim, we just have about 2 minutes left. Give me a sense of what you're up against in this primary. How many other candidates are there?
Yep. There's one other Democratic candidate, and I would argue that he's confused about the fact that he's a Democrat. He is a proclaimed centrist. I would argue he's center-right, Republican-light. He checks a few boxes for people down at the DCCC with his resume. But this is a guy who hadn't lived in our district since he was 18. He just moved back here in June from Northern Virginia. You know, he's carpetbagging in and has got the support of some of the establishment folks because they're afraid to put forth a bold progressive candidate and actually stand on our ideals. You know, this is a guy who is raising his, where our campaign is driven by grassroots contributions. You know, the majority of our contributions are from people donating under $200, and they are from people within the 4th District. This other guy's taking money from everywhere. He's got hedge fund billionaires. He's got defense contractors. He's taking lobbyist money. He's taking money from oil and gas executives. In terms of policy, he said H.R. 676 is just an idea. It's a theory. It's not a real bill. I believe in a $15 federal minimum wage. He doesn't. I believe in federalizing marijuana, making marijuana legal for both medicinal and recreational. He says it should be left up to the states. I am for publicly financing our colleges and universities. He's talked about the possibility of publicly financing our community colleges. And then in terms of strategy, I want to go after our Democratic base and left-leaning unaffiliated voters. He has said that that's a waste of time, and he believes he's going to peel off 30% of Congressman Smith, a 38-year Republican, 30% of his Republican base to win this thing.
Jim, where can people get more information and read up on you and perhaps help you out? Well, what's the best
Absolutely.
Place? Where's the best place?
People,
go ahead.
Yep, people can go to jimkeady.com, J-I-M-K-E-A-D as in Democrat, Y.com. And I would encourage people to do their homework. We do it quick because we have 2 weeks from today is the primary in New Jersey, and we need all hands on deck. We need people who will phone bank, and you can do it from anywhere in the country. You want to come to the 4th District, you can sleep on my living room floor. We need people coming in and knocking on doors and making small-dollar contributions to the campaign so that we can get out the vote in the last 48 hours and win this thing. And
Jim, I got to tell you, you're the type of Democrat that we need, and I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us.
Thanks, Sam. I really appreciate it. Always great talking to you. I'm really happy that we got reconnected.
Jim Keady is an entrepreneur, educator, activist, warrior for the common good, and candidate for U.S. Congress in New Jersey's 4th District. You can learn more about his campaign at jimkeady.com. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more of the news of the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com to support the show and hear what you've been missing.